I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Midday. Another not guilty verdict, this one for the highest-ranking Baltimore police officer charged in the death of Freddie Gray. That's where we'll start this hour. Then, DIY biotech. Think of leather created by microbes, bacteria genetically engineered to prevent malaria. In community labs around the world, including one in Baltimore, a growing number of amateur scientists with little academic background are learning the ins and outs of biotechnology. Like computer hackers before them, they hope to democratize a complex technology. What are they working on? Is it risky to let amateurs tinker with the code of life? Or should we all learn these skills as biotechnology increasingly alters our everyday lives? An inside look at DIY biology on Midday after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for tuning in. In a few minutes, we'll get to our main focus today. It goes by several names: do-it-yourself, DIY biology, biohacking, garage biology. A new crop of laboratories, including several in Maryland, are dedicated to these amateurs. It's really interesting, so stay tuned for that. But first, let's check in with WI reporter Kenneth Burns about the news of the day. As you've been hearing on WIPR and NPR, a third Baltimore police officer has been cleared of criminal wrongdoing in the death of Freddie Gray last year. Kenny Burns has covered all four trials of police officers for WIPR, and he joins us now by phone. Kenny, thanks for being with us. What is behind the not guilty verdicts that Circuit Court Judge Barry Williams issued this morning?
Well, to borrow a phrase, a biblical phrase of that, once again, the judge has said, in this case, Judge Barry Williams said, that the state did not present evidence and did not prove their case. The line that stuck out for me is that the court's imaginings is not a substitute for evidence. And he had repeated something that came to that as far as not presenting the evidence or not proving that this happened for each of the different charges, the involuntary manslaughter, the reckless endangerment, and the misconduct in office.
So Lieutenant Brian Rice was the highest ranking police officer charged in this series, among the six police officers charged. He was the highest ranking. He was in charge there that morning that Freddie Gray was taken into custody. And the prosecution argued that that gave him special obligations. Did Judge Williams agree with that part of it?
No, the judge did not agree with that. In fact, as you alluded to, their theory the entire time was Rice should have made sure that Freddie Gray was in the seatbelt himself or told somebody else to do it. Now, specifically, you have two seatbelt orders that one seatbelt order that the prosecution was using.
You're talking about orders from the police department to officers about seatbelting prisoners in vans.
Yes. You have K-14, which was in existence for years. Up until days before Freddie Gray was arrested, that was replaced by 1114. Now, I'm not going to repeat the orders just to keep things simple, but up until the order was updated, officers had discretion on whether or not to seatbelt a prisoner. Well, the new order that came out days before Gray's arrest took away that discretion. And the judge specifically said that if the state did not prove if Lieutenant Rice knew about the updated order or not, and that he was likely operating under the old order, which gave him discretion. And to that end, abundant case law, he said, says that general orders, or which is essentially company policies for police departments, breaking one might show that you did not follow the rules, but it does not rise up to criminal behavior.
Right as the trial was beginning, as the trial of Brian Rice, Lieutenant Brian Rice was beginning, Judge Williams disallowed about 4,000 pages paperwork relating to the training that Lieutenant Rice had been given. Could you tell from the verdict whether the absence of that evidence played a role in the judge's judgment that the prosecution had not made their case?
Well, it was quite clear the judge referenced it in the verdict, and he specifically said that the prosecution was not able to or did not admit evidence pertaining to Lieutenant Rice's academy training or in-service training. The 4,000 pages you're referring to are the documents from when Lieutenant Rice completed the academy. So going back some 17 years of trainings that he took since he completed academy training, the prosecution did not introduce anything from Lieutenant Rice's academy days, which is quite different from the previous trials. Going back to Officer Porter, Officer Nero Goodson, they introduced the training days when they first started their at the police academy. And the judge said this is going to be it affected the case because they weren't able to introduce it. So we're looking at something that might have come back to bit the prosecution in this instance.
So as you mentioned, Officer William Porter has been tried in December. That was a hung jury, and he will be retried in September. Officer Edward Nero and Officer Cesar Goodson have, like Lieutenant Rice today, have been were cleared in a bench trial of criminal wrongdoing. With those trials, does that put the question of whether or not it was criminal not to seatbelt Freddie Gray into the van, is that now over as a question before the court, or will that come up in the coming trials also?
Well, it's likely to come up in the other trials. Remember, we're talking about individual trials, so none of these officers are being tried in a collective. In the case of Officer Garrett Miller, who was in court today, he's the very next trial 1 week from this coming Wednesday. And we're looking at a completely different prosecutorial team because Miller testified in the trial of Officer Edward Nero. And there's already been a motion to see whether or not the new prosecutors are going to use anything from Miller's immunized testimony from the Nero trial, making sure that they didn't use any parts of that because of, again, immunized testimony. So you have that question. And then the ultimate question is, will the prosecution move forward with the remaining three trials?
And obviously I'm assuming that's nothing about that was mentioned in court today.
No, it was solely Judge Barry Williams reading the verdict in court. Whether they dropped the charges against Officer Garrett Miller, Sergeant Alicia White, and Officer William Porter remains to be seen. We don't, unless they do it in open court, we won't know because of the gag order imposed by Judge Williams back in the fall.
Oh, that's right. No one involved with either the prosecution or the defense can talk to you.
No.
So next is Officer Garrett Miller's trial. You said that will start a week from Wednesday.
Yes. And if I was a betting man, I would not be surprised if he opts for a bench trial as well. We won't know until July 27th.
Kenny, I appreciate your bringing us up to date. Thank you.
Thank you.
P. Kenneth Burns is WIPR's Metro reporter. He has been covering the trials for WIPR. This is Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, and we turn now to our main focus for today. We may not be aware of it, but biotechnology is already a part of our everyday lives. Drugs, vaccines, and diagnostic tests, as well as new fuels, and of course, genetically modified food, GMO food, all owe their existence to biotech. In the future, the field is likely to alter our lives radically. Scientists are working on everything from building new organs, to using microbes to clean contaminated water, to creating biological computers. But our show today isn't about scientists, at least not in the traditional sense. It's about amateurs. The idea of a DIY biology movement dates back to around the year 2000, when a working draft of the human genome was first completed. In 2008, an online forum arrived, DIYbio.org. And since then, the movement has steadily grown. There are now nearly 20 community biotech labs in the United States, as well as numerous labs abroad. What's driving this phenomenon? What kinds of projects are people taking on? What are the benefits of a population that understands this emerging technology, and what, if any, are the risks? I have three guests with me today who will help us understand the growth of amateur biology. With me in studio are Dan Grushkin and Ryan Hoover. Dan Grushkin is co-founder of GenSpace, the first nonprofit community biology lab in the country, based in Brooklyn. He's also founder of the BioDesign Challenge, a competition in which art and design students envision future applications of biotechnology. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Ryan Hoover is an active member of the Baltimore Underground Science Space. Think of those first initials, Baltimore Underground Science Space, or BUGS for short. He is also a professor of interdisciplinary sculpture at MICA and has taught courses on biofabrication. Welcome to Midday, Ryan.
Thank you, Sheila.
And joining us from a studio in Washington, D.C. is Todd Kuchen. He is senior research scholar at North Carolina State University in their Genetic Engineering and Society Center. He collaborates with the amateur biology community to ensure safety. He's also a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. with their Science and Technology Innovation Program. Todd Kuchen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And let me start with you. Listeners may be wondering, having heard me talk about all that, about whether do-it-yourself biology is safe. So let's start with that. What kind of fears do you hear people expressing?
Oh, the fears can really take anyone's imagination. Most of the fears revolve around amateurs sort of creating, say, the deadly virus or a bioweapon. Most of these fears are completely unfounded, but they stem from, I think, a general fear of biotechnology in general that has just transferred itself onto the amateur community.
Let me ask Dan Grushkin here with me in the studio: is there anything we should be worried about in this movement?
I think if you're going to have fears around biotechnology, you should be concerned about the capabilities of the technology. Withstanding of who is actually using it. So I wouldn't target the amateur community specifically. I wouldn't target the DIY bio community specifically. I would be looking at the technology and its capabilities themselves.
Todd Kuchen, let me come back to you. How is the government treating these labs? Are you worried that there would be a government crackdown because of the generalized fears that you say don't have a basis, but do you think it might lead to a crackdown?
Sure. So let me take that in two sections. So in terms of the government, one government agency, the FBI, has been actively engaging with the community for the last at least 5 years. And the FBI's outreach has really been about how you can safeguard the science or the technology to enable this community to actually thrive in a safe manner, while at the same time trying to address the potential issues that may arise with amateurs or anyone in society having access to these types of technologies. So those are your typical sort of biosafety and biosecurity concerns. In terms of the regulatory side of the government, there's no specific regulations or laws governing the use of biotechnology, say, in a community biotech lab. But in essence, that holds true for universities as well. While universities have different guidelines that labs follow that deal with issues around safety and disposal and also security, there aren't necessarily specific laws that govern that beyond sort of the issues around select agents. So there are certain laws that restrict access to particular organisms or microbes and those types of things.
We have to take a quick break here in just a minute. And before we do that, I want to pull Ryan into this conversation because Ryan Hoover, you are an artist.
Correct.
What are you doing in this story?
That's a great question. I think as an artist, I've had a longstanding interest in emerging technologies and their social and political implications. So seeing biotech as a very potentially very powerful technology that has these capacities that we've talked about, I think it's critical that we understand how those will play out. And to help other people imagine sort of our futures with these technologies. I think having people involved who aren't just from a kind of science, engineering, technology background, but who are rooted in the humanities, who understand these kind of social and emotional and psychological implications of these things, need to be involved and need to have a seat at the table, and not just kind of commenting from the sidelines, but with a really with a realistic understanding of the technology to inform the sort of broader social discussion.
So that's the why of your involvement. Mm-hmm. How did you get involved?
I guess my first involvement, particularly with bugs, was through a class that they offered.
Again, I should remind people that is the Baltimore Underground Science Space.
Correct.
It is not an insect.
Thanks for the clarification there. So they offered a course on genetic engineering. And it's something that I've been curious about. Most of my cadre of liberal friends had various opinions on GMOs, and I was interested in the subject, and I thought, well, I don't actually understand a lot about this, so why don't I go take this workshop where I can GM some O's and figure out what this means. So that was extremely informative to me. It helped me to really separate some of the issues around the science and the technology from the kind of like economic and sort of and other ecological issues around these that subject. So I think that's what kind of got me started in doing this workshop. So within sort of a 5-weekend workshop at Bugs, I learned basic lab techniques. We took a piece of DNA from one organism and inserted it into another organism and got that to express.
And you were hooked.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, as I said, and you're welcome to be part of this conversation. What do you think of all this? Would you be interested in learning how to genetically engineer organisms? You can give us a call at 410-662-8780, 410-662-8780, or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about do-it-yourself biology. In garages, basements, and community laboratories around the world, amateurs are learning the tools of biotechnology. My guests today are Todd Kuchen, senior research scholar at North Carolina State University, and there in its Genetic Engineering and Society Center. He collaborates with the amateur biology community on safety issues. And with me here in the studio are Dan Grushkin, co-founder of a community biolab in Brooklyn, New York, and Ryan Hoover, an artist and active member of a community biolab in MICA. A community biolab in Baltimore. He teaches at MICA. Dan Grushkin, I want to talk about the first community biolab in the U.S., which you co-founded. Tell me briefly how that lab got started.
So I should give you a brief explanation of how I got into it first. So my background's as a science journalist, and for years I had been covering biotechnologists, scientists in their labs, but I never had the opportunity to actually work in the lab to understand what it takes to make the organisms that they were making. That sort of jealousy that developed from those scientists led me to that message board you mentioned, the DIYBio.org message board, and I found a group of New Yorkers who were also on the message board. We met over hamburgers one night, and we decided we were going to try our first experiment, but we realized we had no space to do it. One after the other, we went around the room. I thought I was going to be covering these people and watch this nascent movement grow. But they needed a place to actually start working, and it became my living room. So we did our first experiment in my living room. We invited people off the internet. As a reward for their experiment, they were going to get some beer and pizza. We basically laid my dining room table with some plastic tarp, spent a long time talking about the safety, and then we inserted a gene that causes bacteria to glow green into a bacteria. In fact, there were so many people in that room, we had crowded out my living room, which said to me that there were a lot of people like me who wanted to learn more, who wanted to see how this works hands-on.
And why do you think that is? Why are you finding so many people interested in learning to do it themselves?
I think there's something very, very interesting about working with the inner, for lack of a better word, electronics of an organism. Meaning you are literally working with how that organism functions. And that's a really interesting, intimate relationship with a living thing. I think that's one part. I think for a long time there's been this message that one day we will be able to treat living biology, biotechnology, like we do computing. And I think that's very appealing to people. I really think it's a different way of understanding life. And I think that's really what's drawing people in. Artists, designers, computer scientists, you name it. I mean, we had our first bartender a couple of years ago come in and be interested in what you can do with biotechnology. So I think there's something there.
I'm sorry. Wait a minute. Let me make sure I understand the import of what you just said. You had a bartender.
Yes.
Are you just describing to me the breadth of the scope, or are you saying he wanted to do something related to DIY bio that he could do in his bar?
The scope.
The scope.
So we are very, very stringent about rules like that. So, no, he wanted to understand. You know, what I'm saying is that there are lots of people from different walks of life who are very interested.
Besides
in what's
bartenders,
possible.
Tell me, just quickly tick off some of the other kinds of folks who.
Architects.
Brian, feel free to jump in.
Ryan
Todd, feel free
here.
To jump in. Who shows up at these things?
Computer scientists, educators, artists.
Architects, computer scientists. We've had finance people show up. Who are interested in their investments.
Todd, are you trying to get
in here? I would say the other interesting thing, too, is the age range of folks that come through there. And Dan and Ryan can probably speak to this, too. But you get age ranges from anywhere from 5 to 95 years old, which, again, I think goes to Dan's point, is that there is just a lot of interest from all walks of life, including the ages of life, that are interested in learning more about this particular science.
And so are a lot of these people, I mean, I'm looking here in the studio at an artist / philosopher who's into this and a reformed journalist who is now, I guess, more of a science type, but still a DIY science type. Are people getting into this because they feel a career change coming on, that they'd actually like to do this full time? Is that true of a lot of people who are participating in this, or is that not really where these folks individually are heading?
I've seen it both ways. So we have people in our lab who have, for example, MBAs who have decided they want to get in the lab and create a startup. We have an electrical engineer who's a reformed electrical engineer with a PhD who's decided biology is the next step for him, and they both have startup companies in our space. But we also have hobbyists who are just interested in, hey, what can I learn about myself if I extract some DNA from myself and start examining it using the tools of biotech? So it's the whole gamut. And then, of course, we have designers and artists who are saying, hey, this might be our new palette. What can we do with this? Which is very exciting as well.
That is Dan Greshkin here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Dan Greshkin co-founded a community lab in Brooklyn, New York, and also founded a biodesign challenge for art and design students. Here with me also in the studio is Ryan Hoover, an active member of a community lab in Baltimore with the acronym BUGS. On the line is Todd Kuchen, a scholar who collaborates with the amateur biology community on safety issues. You can be part of this conversation. Does the idea of amateur biologists using biotech to do things like alter organisms disturb you? Or do you think it's a cool thing? You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. So, Todd Kuchen, why did you get involved in the DIY bio community? You're someone with a traditional academic background.
Sure. So at the time, I was a scholar here at the Woodrow Wilson Center as part of our synthetic biology project. And we became aware of the community when I basically haphazardly met Jason Boeb, the co-founder of DIYBio.org. And I came back from that meeting and was just fascinated with this particular technology of the accessibility of it. So we had also been looking at other emerging technologies like nanotechnology. And with a technology like nanotechnology, the access to that was just so high that the barriers to entry prevented citizens or amateurs to actually be able to get their hands wet, so to speak, with a technology like nanotechnology. But with biotech, we were seeing something very different. And the accessibility of that excited us from a number of ways. One of them was the potential innovation potential that could come from the accessibility of new people coming into a new technology and what might spin out of that, whether that be a startup, a new technology, or what have you. But we also saw it from a couple of other angles. One was an educational angle of allowing people to explore a particular technology really brings a different set of tools for you to have a public engagement around a technology like biotech that obviously has lots of concerns about it in terms of GMO foods or what have you. But we also saw it as a way, as a potential avenue to get people more involved in STEM education. The fact that you had these community labs sprouting up over the last years really does allow people access to the technology, and that could also spur an interest in not just necessarily biotech, but in the sciences in general. So we had a lot of different interest in that. But along with that, we also saw that there were some potential concerns that arose with access to a technology like this, say in a community lab in downtown Baltimore or in Brooklyn, New York. And so we were trying to make sure that we could establish the safety issues and address what those safety and security concerns would be so you could enable this to thrive over the years.
So you're saying that this do-it-yourself community dispersed literally all over the world it brings a different discussion of ethics than the professional labs do?
I think it can. So so if you look at what the DIY community has done, so back in 2011, we helped establish the community to develop their codes of conduct. And this was done very proactively, right as the DIY community was really starting to thrive. So at the time, GenSpace was, I believe, the only operating community lab space in existence. BioCurious in California that was beginning to operate. But these were mostly just meetup groups, similar to the group that Dan described earlier of how he got started. And so what we wanted to do was enable the community to come together and talk about what the issues are, what some of the potentials of the community could be, but also how to address those safety and security concerns. So back in 2011, the community developed their codes of conduct that address issues of safety, security, environmental release, accessibility, transparency. And this was done very proactively, and I argue in a much more robust way than some of your traditional scientists in the community have. If you look at even the recent National Academy studies that have looked at things like gene drives, those studies were only instigated after the scientific work was already done and those concerns got raised. The DIY community has been extremely proactive in trying to identify what those concerns are and putting systems in place to address those safety and security concerns.
So, Ryan Hoover, you are a philosopher as well as an artist, so I will assume that you pay particular attention mm-hmm. to the ethical dimension of this. And you were nodding your head mm-hmm. as Todd was speaking.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of people actually get involved because they are concerned with these social and ethical issues of biotechnology.
Like GMOs.
Right. And so that's not surprising at all to me that this is sort of a recurring theme, not just the type of things that are happening at Bugs, but in labs all around the world. And I think what's interesting about that is that you have a lot – you know, you're injecting a lot of new perspectives into these technologies. You know, if you're trained as a biologist, there's certain ways that you look at things. If you're trained as an engineer, there's certain ways that you look at things. And that leads to really great results in many ways. And I don't think that scientists or biotech engineers are like nefarious in any ways. But if you have these people coming in from other disciplines, they understand how this technology is going to intersect with the work that they're doing. So it's, I think one important thing to understand about this movement is that, yes, these people are amateur biologists in some ways, but they're professional something else, right? So they're bringing in these insights from these other disciplines.
Like you're bringing field. The way an artist looks at something.
Correct, correct. And on top of that, then they're bringing these insights and what they're learning about biotech out into these other disciplines as well.
Before we talk any more in a very broad sense, can each of you give me an example, a really concrete, quick example of a project that either you've worked on or you've worked close by? So I think it's a little hard for people hearing us talk about this to figure out what are you guys doing? So
I'll give you one example. We have a team of students who are competing in what's called the iGEM competition, which is a student genetic engineering competition that usually only universities partake in. We happen to have our own team partaking. They are exploring tardigrades, which are these microscopic organisms which are extremely robust. In fact, so robust you can send them into outer space, bring them back, and they somehow have survived. There's a protein within these tardigrades which allow them to desiccate, which allow them to dry up and yet survive while they dry up. So this iGEM team is exploring how you might take that protein, transport it from this organism into a plant, and then have a plant that's much more robust during drought conditions. That might be an example.
So that's something that you see DIYers
working on. That happens every day in our lab.
Ryan, give me an example.
There's one ongoing project at BUGS, the Baltimore Underground Science Space, where they're working to genetically engineer a bacteria to function as a lead sensor. So the great thing about this is, you know, if you can just put this, if once it's working, you could use this organism, you put it in the presence of lead, and it would express some kind of signaling protein. So it might glow fluorescent red. And they're also working on perhaps methods of containment to make it that lead not bioavailable for humans. So in a city like Baltimore, we can see the value of that. The great thing about that is once you've engineered one of these things and have it working, you can, you know, put in a little media, put it in a shaker, and overnight you have billions more of these things. So the cost for production, you know, drops significantly.
We're going to take another quick break here, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about this trend of DIY biology. I'm curious as to, listeners, whether you think the public should have a role to play in the way biotechnology advances. Is this something that you think makes a lot of sense as you hear about it? You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking today about a social movement that has grown over the past 5 or 10 years, do-it-yourself biology, a public interest in learning the tools of biotechnology and actually using them. I'm speaking with Todd Kuchen, scholar at North Carolina State University's Genetic Engineering and Society Center, who collaborates with the amateur biology community on safety issues. Here with me in the studio are Ryan Hoover and Dan Gresham. Ryan is an active member of a community biology lab in Baltimore known as BUGS, and Dan Greshkin co-founded a similar lab in Brooklyn, New York called GenSpace. You can be part of this conversation. We're curious as to whether you think it's important that the general public understand biotechnology as it shapes the world that we live in, that we can do more than just read a story about it, but actually take part in it. If you think that's a cool thing, give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Dan, you were telling me that Genspace just had a competition. I don't know which of your hats you were wearing when you had this competition, yeah, so, but tell me about it.
So out of Genspace, we founded a program called the Biodesign Challenge. We partnered with universities around the country, specifically art and design schools. Ryan taught a class that was part of the Biodesign Challenge. We asked the art and design students to break up into teams and come up with new visions for how we might use biotechnology to either critique the way that they felt that the science is going or imagine up new applications for the technology. We just finished up the entire year a couple of weeks ago. The students presented their work at the MoMA, at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. And it just was a mind-blowing day to see what students would come up with if given access to scientists and some of the tools of biotechnology. Mind you, none of these students, almost all of these students, had no access until then to the tools of biotech. It was an incredible learning experience for them. And yet they came up with applications that were startling.
I mean,
well, why don't Ryan's a perfect example. His students were
Ryan
great.
Is a startling mutation. What are you saying? What are you saying?
So at our class at MICA, I taught a course on biofabrication. So we introduced a lot of these kind of emerging biotech concepts and did some hands-on work in a small bio lab we set up at the school. We had the class broke up into multiple teams, and with three really great projects. The project that we selected to go ahead and represent MICA at the MoMA was a project called Starter Culture. It's a biomaterials kit. So
a biomaterials kit.
Exactly. So these students, like many artists and designers, they learn from a very kind of hands-on, tactile way. So they wanted to really see biomaterials develop, so materials that are more ecologically friendly, that have interesting novel properties. They wanted to kind of accelerate the development of that and understood the value of having materials hands-on. So they designed this kit that contains multiple sort of biomaterials in it. One of the interesting things about the kit is that with one kit, one of the first projects you can do is make a new kit.
Okay, but I'm still lost at what's in this kit. You said biomaterials, and I mean, I think actually, Todd, I'm not trying to play into the stereotypes here, but when I hear biomaterials, I think biohazardous. Mm-hmm. I think of the logo. So when you say this kit contains biomaterials, can you tell me what that is?
Definitely. So one of the materials is a mycelium. So it's like the root structure for a mushroom. It's really interesting in that if you take a bunch of sawdust and you seed it with this mycelium, these roots will sort of grow into this material and kind of stitch all these little particles of sawdust together. And it'll make
and
a pretty
create a structure.
Yeah. So it makes this kind of like a styrofoam brick. So it's a really,
is it a living thing?
At that point, yes. If you let it keep growing, it'll eventually kind of sprout mushrooms out of it. But there are a number of artists and designers who've been working with this on the West Coast in the Netherlands, and one sort of industrial application where they're actually taking that material, growing very specific forms, and then baking that to sort of kill the organism, and then using that as packing material. The nice thing about that is, like, unlike your styrofoam that then fills a landfill, you can just crumble it up into your garden.
So that's one thing in this
biomaterials kit.
Biomaterials kit.
So it included things like mycelium, silk, with protocols for dissolving silk proteins. Also materials for making bioplastics. So plastics you can make from stuff you buy at the grocery store. The whole idea of this kit is, again, just get materials in people's hands, give them some basic projects. It comes with a set of like 3x5 recipe cards. So it takes this kind of like scientific lab protocol and puts that into a sort of a more familiar format and lets people just try it out, experiment with things. And you can make, so from one kit, you can make a daughter kit. And you can choose what to put in that kit and then hand that off to the next person. And as you kind of come up with your own recipes that work, you include those in the kits that you pass on and document those and upload those to a kind of shared database of recipes.
So Todd Kuchen, when you hear this described, and I realize this is not your project, but does it sound like the STEM education that you were interested in when you first got involved with the DIY folks?
Yeah, I mean, that it's a good example of sort of one of the things that can come out of a movement like this is when you provide people access to a technology like this, not only are they learning about the science of that and better understanding it, you also start to see all of these really new and interesting things that you can do with it that maybe were not originally envisioned, say, in the lab of a university that was utilizing biotechnology.
And again, this, in your view, this goes back to the fact that this is being done by people who aren't, whose vision of what they can do isn't shaped by a class assignment or a grant for their funding for what they're supposed to be looking at.
Yeah, I mean, it's opening it up to new minds, right? So if you compare it, say, to what happened with the iPhone when Apple, in essence, opened up their iPhones for app developers, and now we have thousands, if not millions, of different apps that are available on an iPhone, I don't think anyone could have envisioned all of those coming from one company, for instance. And so the more access you give people to these types of technologies, the better they understand them, the more comfortable they may become with them, and you can start to begin to see all of these really new and exciting areas that develop from the fact that more people have access to the technology.
Dan Grushkin, I listened to this and I realize I'm having a hard time sort of what's the difference between DIY bio or DIY biotech and a startup?
So DIY bio, I would say, is a platform for people who might want a startup. For example, so startup can come from startup entrepreneur can come from anywhere. He might come or she might come from a biotech lab. That person can also come from a DIY do-it-yourself biology space. I think of the do-it-yourself biology spaces as platforms for people to explore. Now, some might want to explore ways in which they might turn a profit. Others might explore ways in which the technology will have societal implications. So those might be the artists, and others might explore themselves and the biology around them or the microbiome that grows on them. Really, the sky's the limit. If you have the tools in a place and the education to use them, it's up to you how you want to go.
How is all this funded? Ryan and Dan are looking at each other like, funding?
Barely.
Oh, there's supposed to be money involved here?
So it's funny because when we started in my living room and then moved to the lab that we had founded in Brooklyn, we didn't really know. The idea was if you build it, they will come. But we didn't know who they were, and we didn't know exactly what we were building. It turned out we were building was a community. And, well, we're just like any other nonprofit. We apply for grants and for funding from donors. And we also have classes. So I think actually one of the big important pieces of all of these labs is that they have classes taught by experts who are teaching in a hands-on way the next generation of DIY bio hackers. So without those classes, the classes fund the space, but then they
Because
people pay nominal fees to take the class.
To take the class. Ryan, you used a wonderful phrase talking to our producer, Andrea Appleton. You said that the labs, I think maybe you're talking about bugs in particular, I don't know, gloriously liberated from funding. And I took this to be that you're pointing out a distinction between how somebody working in a DIY lab proceeds compared to somebody who's actually got a mandate because they have a grant.
Yeah, I think that was somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but it's true. Like, if you have a you know, if you have a particular grant, or if you have a lab that's set up for some particular agenda, you know, then that drives your research to some extent. Whether that's, you know, thinking about how to commercialize that product, or how it fits within sort of the agenda of your funder, those have subtle and sometimes not so subtle influence on the work. For us, for most of the research happening at Bugs, you know, that isn't the case. You know, there's still limitations, and the limitation of not having funding for some of these projects is sometimes much greater than any kind of external influence. But there is definitely a certain amount of freedom that is afforded by that.
I just want to make it clear. So there are usually two ways in which you are involved in a do-it-yourself biology space. You're either taking a class or you're a member of the space, and that allows you to use the tools on whatever project you deem is interesting to you, as long as it fits into the safety guidelines of that lab.
How many of these are there around the world at this point?
There's about 24 now.
Around the world?
Mm-hmm.
Todd Kuchen, why do you think biotechnology in particular is seeing this surge in public interest? And as far as I know, we don't see this these kinds of DIY labs springing up for other branches of science.
Well, I think there was a few sort of confluence of events that were going on. With biotech, you saw a really rapid drop in costs in terms of just basic sequencing, and also access to different types of basic equipment like PCR machines. The other thing, though, is that there is a sort of a larger movement in terms of the maker spaces. So you have another network of fabrication laboratories as well that are providing access to things like 3D printers and laser cutters that are more focused on design, but a similar ethos like DIY Bio, which is providing access to different types of tools and sciences to people that were not necessarily trained in those spaces. The other thing I would say, too, in terms of funding, is that we also now have access to, I would say, pools of money through crowdfunding platforms like Kickstarter, Experiment.com, and Indiegogo that enable people to actually go out there and put their projects online. And if people are interested, they can submit money to those projects, which is also another avenue for some of the projects in some of these spaces to fund themselves.
As we are about to wrap up, Ryan, tell us what kind of Dan was talking about classes. Mm-hmm. Bugs has some workshops coming up.
Yeah, we have we've been running. We have a lot of events at Bugs, including a great series of talks and such like that. So, and those are open to the public for free. So I encourage people to go on the website and check those out.
And we will link to your website.
Great. We have a kind of basic lab skills night. Where you can come in and just in the evening learn like maybe one or two very simple lab skills. And we have our kind of longer term, like a 5-week project coming up that's on CRISPR, which is a very kind of emerging and powerful tool for genetic editing.
I really appreciate you all sharing this hour with us. I learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheila.
Ryan.
Thank you.
Ryan Hoover is a professor in interdisciplinary sculpture at MICA and an active member of the Baltimore Underground Science Space, or BUGS. Thanks.
Thank you.
Dan Greshkin, co-founder of GenSpace, the first nonprofit community biology lab in the country in Brooklyn, New York, and founder of the Biodesign Challenge. Thanks.
Thank you, Sheila.
And Todd Kuchen, senior research scholar at North Carolina State University in its Genetic Engineering and Society Center, and also a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., with their Science and Technology Innovation Program. I'm glad you could join us.
Thank you very much.
Also want to thank the DIS for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The DIS is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. It features signature burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo lump crab cakes, open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on the weekends, on the web at thedisbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. 5 years ago, uprisings in Syria, Egypt, Libya, and other Arab countries seemed to herald a transformation of the region's politics. We discuss the failure of the Arab Spring and how the next president should approach
Middle East relations. I'm Sheila Kast. Have a great afternoon.